And the Labor, Industry, Veterans, and Military Affairs Finance and Policy Committee will come to order. I would like to announce that this meeting will take place in accordance with House Rule 10.01. This meeting may be viewed on House Public Information TV, which is available on the House website. As is custom with this committee, please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance. Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Mr. Petrie, please take the roll.
Chair Eklund.
Present.
Chair Eklund, present. Representative Zhang.
Present.
Representative Zhang, present. Representative Detmer. Representative McDonald. Representative Berg.
Present.
Representative Berg, present. Representative Bliss.
Present.
Representative Bliss, present. Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Edelson, present. Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Frederick, present. Representative Greenman.
Present.
Representative Greenman, present. Representative Nelson.
Present.
Representative Nelson, present. Representative Poston, excused. Representative Raleigh.
Present.
Representative Raleigh, present. Representative Sundin.
Present.
Representative Sundin, present. And Mr. Chair, we do have a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. Petrie. Quorum is present. Next on the agenda is approval of minutes from February 15th, 2022. Representative Raleigh, did you look at the minutes?
Mr. Chair, I have looked at the minutes and I would move the adoption, please.
Representative Raleigh moves minutes from February 15th, 2022. Any questions, additions, or deletions? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed, say nay. Minutes are adopted. Members, we have a presentation, one bill on the agenda today. We'll start with a presentation from Commissioner Rosalyn Robertson from the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. Welcome, Commissioner Robertson. Welcome back to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Good afternoon, Chair Eklund and members of the committee. I do have a PowerPoint presentation, but I believe my staff will advance. Great. So I'm really hoping that we can have somewhat of a discussion here today, but I did put together a few slides and I have a few statistics that I think will be helpful. To begin, this bill concerns wage theft and proposed changes to wage theft. But I think to begin, we need to really understand exactly what wage theft is and why it is so important. We'll let staff get the PowerPoint in the format that's needed. Thank you for your patience.
Not a problem, Commissioner. At least they're not asking me to do it, so we can get.
Thank you. Okay, looks like it's in good order. Okay, first slide. So to begin with, we all recognize that most employers perform their business functions, particularly where it comes to paying workers the agreed upon wage rates. Most employers do this as just as part of the integrity of the business. The majority of the time it works well, it works right. However, when an employer fails to pay all of the wages that are earned by the employee in a timely manner, it is considered wage theft. Common illegal wage theft practices include paying less than the minimum wage. That always jumps out at everybody if someone is being paid $5 an hour or anything less than the statutorily required minimum wage. Not paying overtime, utilizing practices like comp time, or you can take a day off when it's not busy, things like that. If it's an hourly employee and they don't meet the exemption criteria, it is required that individuals be paid time and a half for their regular rate of pay. If it is not done, that too is considered wage theft. Not paying earned tips. Deducting pay for rest breaks of less than 20 minutes. Additional wage theft might include next, requiring employees to work off the clock or having individuals begin work before punching in or after they have punched out if they are using a time clock. Not paying final wages promptly upon separation, or misclassifying an employee as an independent contractor, or misclassifying them in a lower paid classification of labor. Making deductions from paychecks for loss, theft, damage to property without the employee's voluntary written consent. All of those practices constitute illegal wage theft. Next. So, with decades of experience under our belt, in May of 19, the legislature passed the Wage Theft Prevention Act. We got attention from all across the nation, with Minnesota leading the way to having the most comprehensive wage theft law on the books. Included in the Wage Theft Prevention Act, labor and industry received additional funding to implement this law. But before we get to the funding part, I want to talk a little bit about what labor and industry's approach has been since the passage of the Wage Theft Act. Since the passage of the Wage Theft Protection Act, labor and industry, labor standards unit, moved from a complaint-based enforcement program to a strategic compliance model. This model was developed to improve the employer's compliance with the laws under labor standards jurisdiction. Strategic compliance takes a holistic approach to compliance by focusing activities in three areas: education, enforcement, and systems intervention. We began that process immediately, almost simultaneously at the time that the law went into effect. We immediately start putting together processes as to how would we move the agency away from purely complaint-based enforcement process. And the reason we moved was really because as we provide service to impacted employees, we realize that if we rely on a complaint, then we are checking these complaints off really on a one-off kind of approach. Whereas strategic compliance really look at the entire business model to ensure that we are making and having significant impact, not just on the complaint that's on the table, but really looking at industries and sectors so that we can have more meaningful impact. For instance, if previously, if the store across the street, if an employee filed a complaint, we'd only focus on that single employer. Strategic compliance really turns this process around and say, what is it about a particular business model that leads to non-compliance? And what can labor and industry do in the way of not just educating the impacted employers, but what can we do to have a greater impact on a whole industry? For instance, the restaurant industry, if we see certain practices brewing either in a geographic area or in an industry specific area, we want to be able to have a more meaningful impact than just simply collecting the back wages that may have been withheld from a single employer. We're using this information to be really thoughtful, looking at numerous systems, intervention steps, everything that we can to have a more positive impact so that that single employer does not violate the law, violate that same section that's in the same way, but not just that single employer. What can we do to educate the industry to make certain that the entire industry is growing in their awareness of what the specific laws are and how to come into compliance? We currently, we've been using this process now. We have looked at the construction industry. We're looking at the restaurant industry, as well as the personal care attendance industries, because these are the industries that we have seen for years and years and years with responding to those complaints on a one-off. We're really trying to educate employers and employees so that a well-informed employer-employee group are groups that are more likely to comply with the law. Next. So as part of the Wage Theft Protection Act, we did receive an appropriation to stand up this program. And currently the labor standards staff is at full staff. We hired 6 additional positions. We also provided some support in other areas of the agency that is necessary to complete the full process. The investigators start the work, but there's also a great deal of effort that everywhere from communications to the legal services unit or our Office of General Counsel all work to ensure that the investigations that are conducted by the labor standards staff are fully realized, fully complied with, make sure we are putting the cases in good order in case there is litigation that follows. Next. Again, we are working in these 3 particular areas. Our staff have been taught how to put together a comprehensive campaign when we are targeting particular sectors. We've developed campaigns for construction, restaurant, and personal care attendants, and now staff has been trained and is ready to look at other industries if the data supports it in terms of the number of complaints that continue to come in. So when I say we've moved from a complaint-based approach to strategic compliance, that doesn't that does in no way indicate that we're no longer investigating the one-off complaints, but that no longer represent the totality of our work. Strategic compliance is a strategic part of that work, as well as continuing to provide education and outreach for the one-off complaints that the agency continued to get. Next. So, of course, with any new law, labor and industry have always approached its work, particularly in the labor standards area, recognizing that education is a critical part of enforcement and compliance. And so we have taken the resources and really developed an amazing education and outreach approach. Since July of 2019, when the law went into effect, for the next 9 to 12 months following the enactment of the law, labor and industry focused very heavily on educating the employer community on the new provisions under the Wage Theft Protection Act. In total, we participated or sponsored more than 165 outreach events. We provided presentations and webinars to employer groups, chambers of commerce, governmental groups, the Grocers Association, Hospitality Minnesota, Minnesota Child Care. In addition, we also provided information to workers through, we developed a worker-focused webinar. And in total, just in 2020 and 2021, we reached more than 158,000 stakeholders. Now that we are a few years out and the law is being fully realized, we are now making the Wage Theft Protection Act provisions just a part of our regular outreach and education that we provide to employers when we are delivering information on any subject. In addition to the presentations, labor and industry developed 4 videos in 2019, and then we came back in 2021 and developed 11 new videos. We have drafted the employee notice that employers can use, and we have translated those notices into 14 different languages. The videos are also have been translated not into all 14 languages, but in the 4 most common languages that are spoken, including Hmong, Somali, and Spanish. Since the enforcement activities, since the Wage Theft Protection Act indicates that our efforts are definitely going in the right direction, we have recovered substantial unpaid wages just as a result of wage claims. Those are typically the claims concerning the final paychecks when an employee quit or is separated involuntarily. We've also collected substantial back wages, and that those are claims for either minimum wage or overtime, or in some instances, misclassification. So labor and industry is having a significant impact on recovering wages, and the Wage Theft Protection Act has been critical in our ability to persuade employers to pay the wages that are owed. Thank you. Sorry, I lost track of myself for a moment. So with that, Chair Eklund, I think that the statistics really speak for themselves. It really speaks to the necessity of the law. It's a critical tool that we use to continue to persuade employers to simply pay the wages that have been earned by the impacted employees. So with that, I do have other members of my staff that will weigh in on this discussion, but this presentation concludes my initial remarks. I'm happy to address any questions or concerns you might have.
Thank you, Commissioner Robertson. Any member questions for the commissioner? Outstanding job as usual, Commissioner. I appreciate it, and I'm glad that you have staff here for the next portion of this hearing. Members, next up is House File 2662 from co-lead Representative McDonald. The attention of the chair is to delay this bill over for possible inclusion. Representative McDonald, would you please move your bill and introduce it?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to make a motion to lay over for possible inclusion, House File 2662.
Thank you, Representative McDonald. Please, you move your bill. Please introduce it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just a brief overview of House File 2062. The bill makes several changes to the wage theft law, including modifications to the requirements for earnings statements, to employee notice requirements, and payment of wages penalties. It provides a cap for the penalty for not paying wages or commissions within 10 days of the demand. The penalty cannot exceed 15 days of the employer's average daily earnings. Continues the overview. It requires a written warning for a first violation or a violation of the notice requirements. And the bill also allows the commissioner to file an employer fine an employer up to $1,000 for each failure to submit or maintain records and up to $10,000 for each repeated failure. So, Mr. Chair, this bill will really solidify and strengthen the bill that we passed in 2019. We all agree that theft is bad. Nobody's disputing that. However, the law that we passed in 2019 does not distinguish between honest bookkeeping errors and intentional acts to steal or defraud employees. And it imposes significant fines on Minnesota employers. Therefore, it extinguishes vital resources necessary for practicing good, honest management. So this bill will really, I believe, and many do as well in the Senate, really strengthen that bill that we passed and put into law in 2019 and protect both the employers and the employees. So with that, Mr. Chair, I think we have a couple other testifiers, I believe, with the Chamber of Commerce, and I am certainly open for questions, but that's a brief overview of House File 2062.
Thank you, Representative McDonald. We do have a few testifiers. First up is Lauren Schotthorst, Director of Workplace Management and Workforce Development Policy, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Ms. Schotthorst, welcome back to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lauren Schotthorst, and I'm the Director of Workplace Management and Workforce Development Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. As you know, the Minnesota Chamber is a statewide organization representing more than 6,300 businesses of all types and sizes, and more than 500,000 employees throughout Minnesota. The majority of our members are small and mid-sized businesses. Thank you for hearing this bill and allowing us the opportunity to share our organization's perspective today and why we've been advocating for some compliance and process improvements to the new wage theft law. To reiterate very clearly what I said during the development of the wage theft law in the previous legislative session, our organization does not support, condone, or approve of wage theft as a business practice. The message we carried to policymakers as they considered the best approach to legislating on wage theft, the actual proposal itself, was to make sure practical feedback was considered and that caution was exercised so that those willfully engaging in labor trafficking or other such practices were not protected by ineffective laws already on the books, but that employers who inadvertently found themselves in violation of certain confusing or complicated new wage laws were not considered to be such criminals. In other words, when the legislation was being debated, we heard that it was targeted at the less than 1% of bad actors who intentionally withhold wages from employees. And that was a direct figure used by the bill's sponsor in the House at the time. But the proposal as drafted and now law affects 100% of employers, 99% of whom were doing it right already and in a way that worked for their operations and employees and was set up for their HR practices and software if they could even afford software systems. Now, all of those good employers run an unnecessary risk that any error created by some of the redundant, confusing, or unnecessary new requirements could subject them to the law's serious penalties. Penalties that should apply to those bad actors. But scope is an important focus for our members when overly broad or overreaching legislation is being developed. In addition, as you may recall, the law was hastily enacted with a very too fast timeline for implementation, and the rollout was plagued by sometimes confusing and consistent guidance that was issued. In speaking with many businesses and their employees, members of all sizes experienced significant administrative implementation and compliance challenges with the new law. And I will say that DLI was very committed to working with our organizations and others through this. I think we were the department's first webinar. So again, I will say thank you for that, Commissioner. But I think this just underscores the importance of utilizing constructive feedback during the legislative process and being mindful of enactment dates. To give just one direct example of that feedback we received to illustrate the point, and I'll be brief, this was an employer with over 1,000 employees in multiple locations in Minnesota and a couple thousand employees outside of Minnesota. To quote, "We have always taken pride in providing our employees with correct pay and wages. This law unnecessarily burdensome for employers who have always done and continue to do the right thing. The implementation and ongoing administration of these requirements have been overwhelming for our employees within our payroll and HR teams. Our HRIS platform does not have the ability to easily create the employee wage theft notices electronically. So we have been required to pull in administrative assistance from multiple departments to assist with the manual creation, distribution, and tracking of the notices. We've had a standard process in place for a number of years to ensure our employees are notified of their pay upon hire, as well as wage changes throughout their employment. We work hard to make sure our employees are paid correctly via timekeeping, data entry, and audit reports. So the introduction of the notices has created duplication in efforts and has been unnecessary and burdensome." And then, as we all know, the coronavirus pandemic hit, ushering in a new set of HR management challenges and compliance risks before a full understanding of the wage theft law was available to fully take hold yet, while the new law was the standard. So we're here today to thank Representative McDonald and the committee, as well as the department, for everyone's willingness to consider a few minor and reasonable ways to make compliance improvements to the wage theft law so that it's less costly and confusing for employers in Minnesota, while still keeping with the spirit of the law's original intention. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to share our perspective and support for these efforts today.
Thank you, Ms. Chatters. Please stick around in case there's any member questions. Next up, I'd like to welcome the new president of Minnesota's AFL-CIO, Bernie Burnham. Madam President, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Bernie Burnham, and I'm the president of the Minnesota AFL-CIO, the state's labor federation, representing over 300,000 members of more than 1,000 local unions. I am here to testify in opposition to House File 2062. In Minnesota, we believe people should be paid for their work. Unfortunately, we know all too well this isn't always the case. The 2019 Wage Theft Prevention Act was enacted to address the long-withstanding, widespread, and well-documented problem of wage theft in Minnesota, and to ensure working people are paid what they are owed. The law's key components are to ensure that workers know what they are supposed to be paid and that penalties are strong enough to deter employers from violating the law. If HF 2062 were to become law, employers would no longer have to provide wage information at the start of employment, meaning workers would potentially not know what they are supposed to be paid until they receive their first paycheck, up to 31 days after their first day of work. Similarly, employers would no longer have to notify the workers of a change in their rate of pay in advance of the change, meaning workers would not know what they are supposed to be paid until after the fact. In addition, staffing agencies would not have to notify employees of changes to pay information after the initial job placement, so employees of staffing agencies will not know what they are supposed to be paid at subsequent placements. HF 2062 eliminates penalties for a first violation of the written notice requirements, no matter how many violations are found. This allows employers to ignore their written notice requirement, since they are unlikely to be caught, and if they are, there will be no penalty, even for willful violations affecting multiple employees. Finally, the bill limits penalties on the worst actors, employers who fail to pay more than 10 days after service of a demand from DLI on behalf of the employee. The bill caps the penalties DLI can charge at 15 days worth of wages. This would allow the worst actors refusing to pay their employees even a month after service of the demand to simply factor in limited penalties as part of their cost of doing business. We know that many of the workers deemed essential during this pandemic, the people who often have kept our state running, are also in industries that too often have bad actors. Weakening laws meant to protect working families and is a bad idea at any time, but especially bad during a pandemic when so many families are hanging on by a thread. I respectfully ask you to vote no on HF 2062. Thank you.
Thank you, President Burnham. Please stick around if there's any member questions, if you would. Next up is Adam Dunnick, Director of Government Affairs, North Central States Regional Council of Carpenters. Mr. Dunnick, welcome back to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity. My name is Adam Dunnick. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the North Central States Regional Council of Carpenters. Our regional council covers six states in the upper Midwest, and in Minnesota, we represent 12,000 members who are carpenters, floor coverers, millwrights, pile drivers, and industrial workers. The issue of wage theft largely impacts the multifamily sector of construction, specifically in the area of wood frame, drywall, siding, and other similar scopes of work. To begin, I just want to restate what's been said. Wage theft is wrong. It steals from workers. It hurts legitimate businesses, and it costs the area taxpayers, as the wage theft model hurts all of us in our communities. And doing meetings with members across the House and Senate over the last number of years, we found allies everywhere, from urban, suburban, and rural, conservative and liberal, because at the end of the day, they believe that workers are owed an honest day's wage for a hard day's work. In construction, wage theft takes numerous forms. It is often done by misclassifying workers as independent contractors to avoid payroll taxes, workers' compensation, or paying other benefits. Our regional council identified years ago that not only were some construction companies skirting the law just to shave a few dollars from their bid, they actually set up complete business models that relied on wage theft and misclassifying and further cheap labor. Every day in the state, we see carpenters who go to work in unsafe conditions who are not paid the wages they are promised. They're not paid overtime for time they work over 40 hours. They're not paid workers' compensation. They're not likely to have payroll taxes withheld, and oftentimes they're forced to pay back some of the wages that they work for to their labor broker. They mostly are paid in cash. Sometimes they're offered drugs for payment. It's not uncommon for workers to have hundreds of dollars stolen every day and thousands of dollars stolen from them over weeks and months. There are construction sites right now with these kinds of illegitimate business practices that are occurring. Tens of thousands of dollars are owed to workers. It is simply unacceptable. There are also developers and general contractors working in the Twin Cities and around the state who have been warned about these dangerous working conditions and that there are unlawful practices that happen with their subcontractors involved, and that they continue to risk working with these unscrupulous subcontractors and labor brokers. Back in 2019, our organization, the United Brotherhood of Carpenters, started a tax fraud day of action in April with nationally planned events to highlight the lost revenue around tax fraud. Annually, we estimate over $8 billion I'll repeat that again, $8 billion is lost in tax revenue due to wage theft. And a recent study by the Midwest Economic Policy Institute estimates that 1 in 5 construction workers in Minnesota has had their wages stolen. They also estimate that Minnesota loses $136 million in state tax revenues due to construction industry payroll tax fraud, including $65 million in income taxes, $13 million in unemployment insurance, and $58 million in workers' compensation premiums. Now to the substance of House File 2062. Our regional council was originally approached by some of our contractors to explore ways to change the pre-employment notification. We are open to some of those changes. We support some of the language allowing for collective bargaining agreements to be used as pre-employment notification. And we understand that the Department of Labor and Industry has tried to work to clarify that part of the law through their outreach. However, we were not approached about changing some of the consequences from fines to warnings, and we object to those proposed changes. We also strongly oppose any efforts to limit penalties to 15 days. First, the limit places a challenge to recover wages in a timely manner. When construction crews move around so frequently, and sometimes it's hard to have their wages stolen, workers have their wages stolen over an entire season. So if workers are having their wages stolen for months or years, which we encounter regularly, it would be hard for us and unfair for the workers not to be able to recoup more than 15 days of penalties. I want to be clear as I can on this one point. One central argument for cutting down on wage theft is that we have to go after the worst of the worst offenders. Even the business community said this. There's very few bad offenders, but we have to go after the worst of the worst offenders. This is why limiting the penalties to some time period or dollar value is not a good idea. It'll send a signal to construction companies who commit wage theft that there will be a smaller penalty to pay for breaking the law. In summary, wage theft continues to happen every day in our industry. Unfortunately, even in the face of our efforts, the legislature's support, and the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry's commitment, we see it every day in the field. We must continue to raise awareness of this issue within the legal and law enforcement communities, and we must continue to educate local decision makers and communities about the problem. We're going to continue to push developers and owners of projects to demand that we will not stand for this harmful business model. Despite the temptation of low prices, and behind that low price and that low bid is stolen labor. Behind that low bid is unpaid overtime. Behind that low bid that looks too good to be true is an unsafe work environment. And that low price comes at the physical expense and social costs of working people who are exploited, bullied, threatened, and abused, and sometimes trafficked. So I ask that the legislature continue to be vigilant about wage theft and oppose House File 2062. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Donick. Please stick around if there's any questions. Last testifier scheduled today is Deputy Commissioner Nicole Blissenbach, Department of Labor and Industry. Commissioner Blissenbach, welcome back to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, and good afternoon, Chair Eklund and members of the committee. My name is Nicole Blissenbach. I serve as the Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. I am here today to testify in opposition to House File 2062. Before jumping into the particular concerns with this bill, I want to remind the committee of some of the many reasons for the Wage Theft Prevention Act and its requirements. At the department, we know firsthand the devastating effect of wage theft on working Minnesotans, both to their financial well-being and their health and safety in the workplace. But these negative impacts extend far beyond individual employees. Wage theft adversely affects employers who play by the rules. For example, an employer who misclassifies employees as independent contractors or pays workers off the books results in the employer's failure to pay unemployment insurance and other payroll taxes or buy and protect workers with necessary workers' compensation insurance. Misclassification also typically results in the failure of an employer to pay workers required overtime compensation. This gives these employers a significant unfair competitive advantage over those employers who follow the law. The Wage Theft Prevention Act addressed some of these concerns by introducing criminal consequences for wage theft and increasing resources for the department for enforcement, but also increasing worker access to information directly related to their terms and conditions of employment. Worker education and knowledge is an incredibly important component of combating wage theft. With that background, the department's concerns can be broken down into three main categories. First, some of the proposed changes will roll back much-needed worker protections established in the Wage Theft Prevention Act. Second, some of the changes specifically remove necessary deterrents to bad behavior. And third, a number of the proposed changes are unnecessary because the department already reads the language to do what the proposed changes are attempting to do. Just a few examples. The bill eliminates the requirement that employers provide the written notice to employees at the start of employment and instead requires it to be provided with the first earnings statement. This is an example of rolling back worker protections. The department's concern is that this would allow an employer to not communicate important terms of employment like pay or exemption from overtime for up to 31 days. employers are required to fill out other paperwork at the start of employment. It's important to the department that employees understand their terms of employment at the beginning of their job. The bill eliminates the ability of the department to issue penalties upon the first finding of a violation of the initial notice or change notice requirements. Currently, the law allows the commissioner to issue civil penalties to employers who are found to have repeatedly or willfully violated the initial notice or change notice requirements. So the department is concerned about this because the proposed change takes away the department's ability to issue that penalty when we find a willful violation. This would take away any incentive for an employer to comply or even attempt to comply with the law until after they are caught. Similarly, Section 2 reinstates the 15-day cap on penalties for failure to pay wages owed after a demand by the commissioner. The department is not supportive of reinstating this penalty cap because it provides no incentive for an employer to pay the wages demanded and owed. Finally, there are proposed changes that add language allowing for electronic distribution of notices and signatures, but this language and the department's published guidance already allows for electronic distribution of notices and signatures. This is an example of one of the changes that is unnecessary because it's what the language already provides and how the department already interprets it. So in conclusion, the department's goal is to ensure the law as implemented provides strong protections and deterrence against wage theft. The bill makes that goal harder to achieve, which is why the department opposes the changes presented in House File 2062. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. For your testimony, please stick around if there's any questions. That's the end of our testifiers. Any member questions? Seeing none, Representative McDonald, any final comments for the committee?
Yeah, thank you. Yes, you know, when Representative Mahoney said in his testimony regarding the problem with wage theft, he said it was only 1% of employers, and yet Ms. Burnham said it was widespread amongst Minnesota employers. So I think there might be a disconnect there between the intent of the bill and the author of the original bill and what's happening. I think that's still true, that 99% of the employers are very honest with their employees and not making mistakes. And wage theft is very serious. We take this very serious. Now, I'll agree that maybe the 15-day cap is probably not enough, but in perpetuity certainly isn't. There must be, Mr. Chair, a common ground that we can work together. To err is human. And to have a $1,000 fine on that first error and a $10,000 fine on the second error is very excessive and punitive to employers. And it certainly isn't good for relationships within the companies. So I think we have to have a common ground, certainly not have a cap of in perpetuity of penalties. If there was an error or even a dispute between the employee and the employer, that in perpetuity penalty that could go on, drag on for months and months, even a year. And that is very excessive. So I think that we need to put in law some kind of cap that makes it fair and equitable for employers, and at the same time allowing employers the benefit of the doubt for a one-time mistake. To just arbitrarily slap them with a fine and not even allow them any explanation for an error, that's punitive, and that's not fair for our employers and employees at all. So I just say that in closing, Mr. Chair, that we need to really strengthen the wage theft law. All our testifiers, the good testifiers, you did a fine job, although you were acting as though we wanted to get rid of the 2019 law. And you reiterated many of the talking points that we talked about years ago, and those have already been taken care of. That's why we have the law. We just need to strengthen it for both the employer and the employee. And my law does that. But I'll certainly work with you. I know that the Senate, Senator Pratt, has been working with the commissioner. He did state that Commissioner Robertson and that agency has been very good to work with and very understanding to employers at this point. But I think we need to put law, strengthen those areas to give the benefit of the doubt for employers for error, at least a one-time offense at this point. And then also the cap. We really need to secure that and have a cap and find a happy medium if 15 days isn't enough. So I guess that's, I ask for a possible, consideration for my bill and the omnibus bill to include it. And I guess that's all I have to say, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative McDonald. And I agree the Department of Labor Industry is an outstanding advocate for our workers and for our good employers. We need to take care of the bad ones. Representative McDonald renews his motion that House File 2062 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Any further questions or comments from members? Seeing none, our next committee meeting will be Tuesday, February 22nd. We currently have two bills on the agenda. We are adjourned.